Max Hartwell was born in 1921 in New South Wales, Australia. He spent much of his early life in the tiny village of Red Range, the centre for a community of small, mixed farms. No one was rich, but none were desperately poor. Self-reliance, hard work, and an obligation to neighbours in the community were the values that prevailed in the outback. Government was invisible, save for the post office and the small school where Hartwell's father was the teacher. This background was to have a profound effect on his worldview and his later work as an economist and historian. After school and teacher training, Hartwell attended Sydney University, where he took a leading role on the sports field and a first-class honours degree in economics. He then embarked for Van Diemen's Land, now the island of Tasmania, to write his MA thesis. Contrary to the orthodoxy of the times, he argued that Australia had benefited from British colonialism, enjoying huge economic growth during a period of increasing liberalism and industrialisation. Newly married to childhood sweetheart Lorraine, Hartwell said goodbye to family and set sail for England and Oxford University to continue his studies. There was still post-war rationing, but the intellectual atmosphere was rich and exciting. He turned his attention from the colonies to the Industrial Revolution, where he would make his name. At just 29 years old, Hartwell returned to Australia and a chair at the newly established University of New South Wales. He might have seen out his academic career in his home country, but it was not to be. Hartwell clashed with the authorities over the issue of political tests applied to lectureships. Ironically, he became the advocate of a professor excluded by the university for his Marxist sympathies, and he eventually resigned his chair in protest. In 1956, he returned to Oxford as reader in recent social and economic history, and then as professorial fellow of Nuffield College. Over the next 30 years, he would establish an international reputation as a historian of the Industrial Revolution. Always active in the broader debate on modern capitalism, he took on the Marxists, Hobsbawm and E.P. Thompson, and relished the fight. He has lectured and held a number of visiting professorships, particularly in the United States, at prestigious institutions such as Chicago Business School, at Stanford University, and at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Hartwell's body of work features a variety of publications on the Industrial Revolution, as well as contemporary economics and a history of the Montpelerin Society. Now retired, Hartwell lives in Oxford, in the village of Old Marston. At 80 years old, he is still writing and working from his study at home, with his family around him. He spends some of each year in France, where he indulges a taste for good food and wine. A former student of Hartwell's here at Nuffield College, Patrick O'Brien is now Centennial Professor of Economic History at the London School of Economics.
Max, how are you? Good to see you. I finished my thesis. Yes.
They met at the Hartwell home in Old Marston to talk about Hartwell's life and work.
Max, I think one of the things that most of your many students would recognised as your most enduring and endearing characteristic is your great capacity for friendship. Friendship across a spectrum of people, most of whom, in their dealings with you, have disagreed with the ideological and political positions that you've taken on the great issues of the day. And having done a bit of work for this interview, I realised that that capacity for friendship and to retain the friendship of people that you disagree with has really grown out of your own early childhood and background in Australia. So I think we might start this interview by elaborating a bit on the values that you imbibed as part of your early life.
Now, I have no doubts that my upbringing in Australia was extremely important in determining or influencing my worldview, if you like. See, I was brought up in a small village called Red Range on the northern tablelands of New South Wales, about 13 miles from a small town called Glen Innes. And It was a rural community of mixed farming, no one very rich, no one very poor. But what was interesting about that is that you were hardly aware of the state. The only two functionaries of the state in the village were the school teacher, who was my father, and the postmistress. You're quite right in talking about a communitarian spirit in the village. I will remember the occasion when two farmers, adjacent farmers, didn't like each other very much, in fact, didn't like each other at all. And one of them got sick during the harvest, whereupon the chap and his sons came across and did the harvesting for him. On the clear understanding that, of course, that that if he didn't do the harvesting, the other chap would be very much impoverished by not getting his harvest in. And that sort of spirit was, I think, was general in the village. Again, that's the other thing about Australia. You're not aware of class in any sense at all. Mm. There are some people wealthier than other people, but there's some people feel superior to other people. But I've always say about Australians that, for example, I don't mind people feeling superior to me because I don't feel inferior to them. So there's no symmetry in the relationship. See, deference, you need a symmetry. I have to feel inferior and he has to feel superior, or she or he. And Australians don't have that. On the other hand, you do recognise differences in wealth. I mean, that's an obvious point. But again, see, wealth did not give you a different way of life.
Looking back at it, don't you find it rather strange that, located as you are in Asia, that you had this strong emphasis on British history, not something, and you developed attitudes that would not have been shared by your Indian compatriots in Asia?
No.
You're also part of the great British Empire.
Yes, but see, Australia, until 1939, was 96% British. All the institutions, whether it's religion, schooling, see, for example, all the high schools, so-called, of New South Wales were based on English grammar schools.
Yes.
The law, the common law, which after all is apart from USA and the British, is not generally... and of course, the language. I mean, probably the greatest gift in a way to the Australian colonists was the language. But the odd thing, see, I said before, that far from being ashamed or... of the association with Britain and the Empire, we felt that made us that more important. We belonged to this great empire. We were part of it. We were an important part of it. We yes. fought in the wars and so forth. And I find the modern stance very difficult to accept. I mean, I understand it, but I don't like it. And that, again, was... well, again, the idea that you were British was not a difficult one to accept. And that's one of the things I reacted against. See, when I went to university, the most popular historian was a chap called Brian Fitzpatrick, who wrote two books, one called The British Empire in Australia, one called British Imperialism in Australia. And I just couldn't get it. I couldn't see the Australians were an exploited race, especially when we built the British at cricket, I mean, or English at cricket. And the idea that we were somehow impoverished in a real sense, but also spiritually by the British Association, it was just so counterintuitive that I never accepted it. So that reaction against the idea of imperialism was also basic to my ideas of liberalism and so forth. But
Max, you did a combined honours degree at Sydney University in economics and history. And throughout your academic career, you've always crossed and recrossed the borders of these two great subjects. And as part of that, or not as part of that, as a result of that, this led you towards economic history, I thought very logically and naturally. And you wrote a thesis on Van Diemen's Land, which I had occasion to read again recently, and I much admired. And do you still hold by most of the views that you published in your very first book, or... have you, in fact, changed your mind about any of them?
Well, doing that reinforced ideas I already had. So I wrote this book and for my MA thesis, and I say it was a good thing to do because I think it guaranteed my overseas scholarship. But as for changing my views, no. I'll just read you one sentence at the end of the introduction, which I wrote. I wouldn't change a word of it. Talking about Mr. Fitzpatrick, who wrote these books, British Imperialism in Australia and so forth, it is a pity to be so indignant about Australia's wrongs as to lose sight of its achievements. In any case, it would be difficult to prove that British imperialism in Australia was harmful either by delaying or impeding development or by making unreasonable demands for tribute and political subservience. Van Diemen's Land was not exploited. Commerce was of mutual benefit. Debt payments, though sometimes embarrassing to the individual settler, were not excessive and were the normal costs of development. The subsistence economy, the convict society, the political autocracy were all transformed by the joint efforts of the English capitalist and the sheep-growing colonist. Of course...
That's a wonderful piece of prose.
Yes, it is good. Definitely.
And it obviously impressed a number of people because that led you to your overseas scholarship back to the metropole... back to the centre, back to the heart of the empire, in fact to one of the great imperial colleges of Oxford, Balliol College, where you came to read a doctorate, I think it was in 1958, was that
48.
Right? 1948. Did you want to come to Oxford?
Oh yes, I mean, there were two professors, one of economics and one of economic thought. John Linnaeus wanted me to go to Oxford and the Professor of Economics wanted me to go to Cambridge.
Yes.
Because I chose Oxford, the economics professor was really very miffed. He said anyone who's interested in economics should go to Cambridge. Well, at that time...
It was true.
It was probably true because it was still...
the height of the Keynesian Revolution.
Keynesian Revolution and so forth.
Yes.
But I... Not that I knew much about either place, but somehow the Oxford had caught my imagination. And I never regretted it because I had Balliol was a good college to be at, and I loved Oxford, I went ahead and to write a thesis. Well, in deciding on a thesis, I didn't want to do just Australian history because I could do that in Australia, but I wanted something with an Australian input. And so I worked, my doctoral thesis was on the Woolen and Worsted Revolution, a Woolen and Worsted industry during the Industrial Revolution in Yorkshire.
In Yorkshire.
And, of course, the supply side brought in Australia, because Australia was producing no wool in 1800 and was the largest wool producer in the world by 1850.
So it was an obvious connection, really,
obvious
for a young Australian to pick.
It was. Yes. Now, that had all sorts of beneficial effects. First of all, a question soon came up in my mind about the standard of living of the woolen workers. And I couldn't help comparing them to the Australian convicts. And it seemed to me that the Australian convicts really did very well out of the system of transportation. Most of them served their sentence out and became free citizens. Very few returned to Britain. They pursued their fortunes in Australia. Some of them, you know, most of them just became ordinary citizens, labourers and so forth, but a lot of them became wealthy and they became merchants and carpenters, etc., etc., etc. And then, of course, I began to read extensively on English economic history. I'd done a fair bit in Australia. And Ashton had written an article about 1948, which showed to his satisfaction that the standard living of the workers in England had risen during the Industrial Revolution. Well, then a very famous article by Hobsbawm came out, which showed that the standard living had deteriorated. And as a result of my research, I wrote an article called The Rising Standard of England, 1800-1850. Well, of course... I made myself famous by opposing the leading Marxist in England. Of course, I knew I was right and he was wrong, as you can well understand. Give some flavour to that, I mean, many, many years ago, back about 3 years ago, I was attending a seminar in Oxford here, and it was given by a lecturer at Brooks University. And he raced up after he'd given the seminar and said to me, "Oh, I'm glad to meet you. I've always wanted to meet you, Dr. Hartwell." And I said, "Well, how's that?" He said, "Well," he said, "I was a student during the 60s when it was very exciting. It was Hartwell versus Hobsbawm and Hartwell versus Thompson." He said, "Really exciting. And he looked at me and said, of course we hated you, he said.
Yes, and that was the core of your career, really, was as a reader in economic and social history
in Oxford,
at this brand new college.
Yes.
Funded by a motor magnate, Lord Nuffield.
Yes, indeed.
And full of dons who were not exactly of your political persuasion.
You can say that again.
One could say it was a kind of centrist Labour Party, Social Democratic college.
Exactly that. They were not...
Devoted to improving the state and making sure the state did things
right
within the economy. I mean, how did you... with that particular mix or that particular culture?
Well, it's obvious by this time that from that quote I gave in Van Diemen's Land how I thought about this, that and the other. And there were three, I say, widely held beliefs in England at that time which I didn't think were tenable. The first one was that governments could set objectives and attain them by the manipulation of some key variables. Well, of course, we all know that's not true. Even you would admit that. It was, of course, the result of Keynesianism, because, you know, Keynes thought that you could do this. The other thing, of course, they didn't recognise was what Hayek called the unintended consequences of well-intentioned actions, and very often they achieved the opposite of what they set out to do. Anyway, that was one, the government role. The second was that you have in the public sector quite unselfish public servants whose main interest and only interest is serving the public. I think you do have a lot of people who...
didn't you, in England? Mandarinate of that kind.
You did have a lot.
At that moment of time, anyway.
Yes, you did. But, of course, the idea that they had no other interest and so forth, and there wasn't conflict of interest, and especially in local government. I mean, in England, you had very little central corruption at any time in our lives, but you've had it in local government quite extensively. Yes. But anyway, I thought that I think one of the most promising parts of modern economics is public sector analysis. Whether you like Tony Atkinson, who believes in it, say, or Jim Buchanan, who doesn't. The third one was, of course, the one which got me from the standard living, is that that the trade unions were the people who really were responsible for the rise in living standards of workers, that was it. Well, of course, I knew that was wrong. Economic growth did far more than trade unions. Now, I think trade unions were very important in the 19th century because there was an imbalance in terms of their status and recognition, and I think they're very important in increasing the self-respect and awareness of the working classes. But as for putting up, they put up standard living, some people, sometimes, but, I mean, in general, standard living's increased as the economy grew. And I mean, I think that even Hugh Clegg in that big volume of his says that.
Max, when your generation represented the British and by implication the Anglo-American Industrial Revolution, they brought to the fore such things as British institutions, including freedom, laissez-faire, free enterprise, the common law, democratic government, and an entrepreneurial and enterprising people. But as we've seen from a whole body of recent research, these things were present elsewhere, particularly in northwestern Europe, not least in Holland, but latterly we've discovered in maritime China, in southern India. Other historians have emphasised the lucky element about this offshore island, particularly its massive endowments of cheap, accessible coal, and also the fact that despite our best endeavours, the attempts to explain these technological breakthroughs, the big machines that we all know about, they seem to be kind of inexplicable, except in terms of individuals like Watt or Arkwright or Cartwright, who just happened in that moment of time to be British people. Other historians like myself have emphasised the role of power, something that Adam Smith inveighed against when he talked a lot about mercantilism. Nevertheless, if you take foreign trade and commerce seriously and ask yourself the question, why was it in the 18th century that the British, of all other European peoples, obtained such a large share of world trade and the profits from servicing the international economy, we cannot ignore the massive investment in the Royal Navy and in military power which gave us that lead, and the luck which came from the fact that the French launched their revolution upon an unsuspecting Europe and set back our competitors for several decades. In that respect, we were a bit like the Americans after the Second World War. One cannot account for the American lead except in terms of that particular war, and a similar kind of story is now being told by historians about the British Industrial Revolution. So I think that the Industrial Revolution since your time has been reconfigured. It is now less celebrated. It seems less of a discontinuity and less of a great divide. Do you think that all the intellectual energy and time that you've spent on this event is now justified in the light of the newer perspectives that are emerging on the Industrial Revolution?
No, I think that my view of that view you expressed is completely viable. There's no doubt in my mind that the Industrial Revolution is one of the two great economic discontinuities in world history, the other one being the Agricultural Revolution, what, 10,000 BC. It dramatically changed the world in the long run. In particular, of course, it led to the massive growth of industry and services. Now, the interesting question is, how did the rest of the world industrialise? To what extent was England helpful? Well, I think the first question is, why did it come first in England? And I think there the...
Or did it come first in England?
Yes, it did. No doubt about that.
What about Song China?
Well, in Europe, then, it's the first... But they never... Again, see, the interesting thing about China is they advanced to a certain stage and then stopped. Mm-hmm. In the 12th century, for example, the metallurgy was probably as advanced or more advanced than that of Europe. Mm-hmm. But there was no industrialisation. It just sort of stopped.
Well, they had a very large share of the workforce and industry, if you look at... towns.
And in commerce. Oh, yes. But again, see... I think this is interesting, and as you know, Eric Jones, mutual friend, has done great work on this. But, and I wouldn't, I think I just really don't know enough about industrialisation of China and so on to be authoritative on it. But certainly in Europe, Britain was first. If you like, I take the Whig interpretation of history, and I believe it very strongly. nowhere in Europe... I can't speak for Asia or India. I don't know enough about it. Nowhere in Europe did you have such this favourable combination of factors. And again, even on technology, I mean, there was another country whose technology or it could look as though it might be superior to British or could be was France. But England had an interesting combination. Education and opportunities, which certainly stimulated people, I mean, even like clergymen, to invention. Invention, of course, is to some people a mystery, but I don't believe it is. I think it's systematic. I believe that most invention is systematic, not just an heroic consequence, heroic incident. And if you look at the inventions of the Industrial Revolution, nearly all of them were inspired by bottlenecks in the production process. That occurred in textiles, in the smelting of iron, and so on and so forth. And I was always struck by the example of in the woolen industry, of the invention, proper invention of machines to card wool, but also the spinning of long wool. It's very difficult in many of these inventions to actually pin it to an individual. In other words, high proportion, for example, the speed at which the spinning machine moved, I can't remember the figures, but increased 8 times sometimes, say, in the first 30 years. There's no invention which would explain that. It was the work of the artisans on the job, which small advantages, small changes gradually increased. Now, I think that shows that, you know, that there's a whole generation of tinkerers, or whatever you like to call them, and that was not uncharacteristic of other inventions. that much of the invention of the Industrial Revolution is not heroic, it's systematic. It comes by having a breakthrough, certainly, and then gradual refinement by the workers on the job. It's, you know, the modern phrase, learning by doing. But it's the total combination of those factors, the type of government, the common law, the resources, which I think was unique in England. There was no other country. When you take other countries in turn, you find that they're missing some of the essential ingredients, which in the case of England brought about the Industrial Revolution.
So you would not agree with our colleague Jan de Vries, who's written a classic book in the last 2 years called The First Modern Economy, giving most of the credit to the Dutch for being the first modern economy.
Well,
is there something wrong with that thesis?
No, well, given his premises, it's okay. I mean, he wasn't talking about industrialisation. He's talking about an economy which had a high degree of services and international trade and so forth, but very little industrialisation. So I think in the long run, there's no doubt that the big change was industrialisation, urbanisation, population growth and so forth. And that discontinuity seems to me, you know, I think it's just absurd to even deny it. I mean, I think it's so obvious that it doesn't need supporting by any more than the statistics. The reason why England was first, I think, is the more interesting question, quite apart from... And that seems to me, you know, you yourself have worked on one of the main reasons, that is the mercantile estate predating the Industrial Revolution. Prepared the way for industrialisation by having a government which was very committed to increasing commercial dominance of the world and financing a large navy and increasing international trade. Now, all these, I think, were... But part behind that, of course, was the institutions of Britain, particularly the common law and government. If you look at, say, France had a wide variety of regions, their own weights and measures, even sometimes weights currency, different law codes. England had a unified, and I don't use the word very strictly, unified state, by the 16th century. Weights and measures were common throughout the country. The government was the common law. What it had also, of course, was strong local government, which was not part of the European scene. The European countries were all strongly centralised where they could be so. If you see, for example, the absorption into the common law of the lex mercatoria, the law merchant, a medieval time, it comes first in England than on the continent. So by the middle of the 17th century, you had, in effect, modern commercial law, the recognition of claims to... paper claims to property in estates and so forth. But the common law, of course, is against the civil law, is a law which goes on what happened in the courts and the judge deciding what was sensible, in effect. And therefore it was continually revised. In a period of rapid change, that was very beneficial. To change the statute law, the civil law, was much more complicated. It had to be done centrally and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and what you point out in the various writings is that the gradually the shearing off of restraints on trade and so forth were extremely important. I did an article I never published some time ago where I asked... If an entrepreneur started in 1600 on an enterprise and then another entrepreneur started in 1775, what was the difference in the story? Well, the difference in the story is in 1775 there was practically no restraints on any entrepreneur starting a business. He could buy the land, he could employ the workers, he could buy the capital goods, and he could go forward. In 1600 there were many constraints, I mean on mobility of labour, for example, and so forth. So Britain, and particularly England, but Britain, in the middle of the 18th century, was quite capable of sustaining an industrial revolution.
But you continually use this word industrialization, though that's the essence of the matter. The essence of the matter must be rising per capita standards of living, must it not? Which
yes.
is not coterminous with industrialization.
No, it isn't.
I mean, the Dutch standard of living was, we now believe, was above ours till well into the 1830s.
Yes, well, it could
so
well.
There's a modern economy with a high standard of living.
Right.
No industrialization.
Well,
so a Dutchman would say, so what? We didn't need it.
Well, in the long run, they did need it, but never mind. Now, I will take the point about Land of Reason and Holland. Holland was the country with the highest standard of living outside of Britain. There's no doubt about that.
Mm.
And also, of course, it was a small country and fairly homogeneous. So, it could, whereas places like France was really a whole series of regional economies, and so was Germany,
mm-hmm.
So was Italy. And England had that advantage of a uniform society. But I also, you know, take the Adam Smith point that... that it was the institutions which were so congenial for development in England. He says something, you know, I've forgotten the words, but what determines industrialization to an important extent, and especially leadership, is the congeniality of the institutions to
yes.
or conducive to growth. Now, the interesting thing about interpreting the Industrial Revolution is, of course, the original writer, I mean, the person who wrote the first book using the term, that's the elder Toynbee, stressed, of course, laissez-faire.
Yes.
Subsequent economic historians seem to forget that, and what they talked about mostly was resources, as though it was resource-driven, or technology, as though it was technology-driven.
Coal, technology and political power are now the three things that are in,
well,
rather than laissez-faire and institutions.
In some people's opinions.
Yes, I'm trying to probe towards your views to see
whether they've become
more flexible and modified.
Oh, they've been... I think a man's a bad historian if he doesn't read and try and take in everything
sure.
that's... and you know, I've read... Well, one of the things about being editor of the Economist Review is you read everything. You had
yes.
to.
Yes.
But I don't think there's any mystery myself in England's leadership. And, of course, the other thing is in the 19th century, where it became the dominant economic power of the world, and I think there was a combination of free trade, factor mobility, including labour and capital, and also convertibility, a sound currency.
Don't you think that a lot of that dominance was provided for them by the French Revolution, the long wars against France, which destroyed similar promising developments that were going on in Saxony, in Holland, in northern France, large parts of Europe, which left Europe devastated for three or four decades, incapable of mounting a serious challenge to England, either economically or politically?
I think devastated is too strong a word. There's no doubt that... See, don't forget that the Napoleonic Wars had a big impact also on British economy and life, because for 20 years or more, the economy was geared to a war economy.
Yes.
And you know yourself about... you studied the national debt over this period.
Mm.
Industry was skewed, but of course it was skewed in view of subsequent history beneficially towards iron goods and textiles. But again, see, when you get the standard of living, there's no doubt that the Napoleonic Wars slowed down or even brought to a halt the increase in living standards which you might have expected from industrialisation.
Yes. You seem to be determined to stick to something called British exceptionalism, which
a
modern generation would not. Because they find, when you start listing the things that people who believe in British exceptionalism, they not only find them in Europe, they now find them all over maritime China, South India, they find them in Tokugawa Japan. I mean, all these institutions that we think of as... the rise of capitalism or Smithian growth, they're very, very, very widespread.
I wouldn't use the word capitalism.
There's nothing particularly British about them, is there?
Well, I think there is. But see, again, it's the total package which I think was important in the case of Britain.
Mm.
And especially the increasing use of the market. which by the middle of the 18th century more or less determined all production decisions. Exceptionalism is not quite a word I'd use. I think it's not difficult to explain England's leadership in industrialisation. It's also obvious that countries like Holland and parts of France and so on had parts of the economies which were advancing. But England had the advantage of size, of uniformity, for example, of currency and standards and weights and measures, of strong government without being authoritarian government, of strong local government, which is also favourable to economic growth, also a government which, by increasingly liberalising politics, secured, it always had, I think, or secured the allegiance of the bulk of the population who saw industrialisation. But again, so you didn't, I don't think you mentioned capital accumulation. See, England, let's say it stick to England, was a rich society. And you know there's a famous article by Poston written many years ago in showing that there was enough capital at any time in the 18th century to finance the Industrial Revolution. It's when people stopped and not stopped, but didn't invest so much in country houses and put them more into factories that you had this ongoing industrialisation. And of course, I think, again, once it starts, it has its own momentum. I wrote an article once, of course, which is very much opposed to the theory that industrialisation starts with a key industry which spreads. See, I think if you look at 18th century England, there's enterprise in every area of the economy, every part of the country. Mm-hmm. And there was what I'd say balanced growth, not unbalanced growth. But backing it all, again, I say it was really a freedom of association, a freedom of enterprise, a political freedom, which was unique in Europe.
Is it a liberal state that invests massively in naval power, blows its rivals out of the water, expropriates a huge share of international trade and services, makes sure the Dutch don't rise again, cripples France? Is that a liberal state in your view?
Yeah, well, I don't quite accept that, you know, this...
Or is it a mercantilist state?
Oh, well, it's a mercantilist state up to the end of the 18th century. You know that. Oh, yes.
But then mercantilism
gives way to industrialisation, and mercantilism aids industrialisation.
Provides a platform for it, doesn't it?
It helps it considerably, yes.
Yeah.
And the growth of international trade is not just a matter of naval dominance either. I mean, a lot of trade was...
But why did your generation, including Ashton, evade power in the way that they did?
Well, I've never evaded
Liberals
power.
Don't talk about power, do they?
No.
Ashton hardly talks about power.
No, he
power.
Doesn't. I always talked about the state. I mean, I talked about the state and the common law and so on and so forth. Mm. And as I said, I've stressed it to you, is that it was the... peculiar character of Britain, politically, economically, legally, which was unique in Europe.
Yes.
And I think that, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And of course, again, in the growth of democracy, where, I mean, again, there's no doubt about that. I mean, you finish up with universal manhood suffrage by the 1880s. And of course, it's the English government, as were, knew when to retreat. And therefore, you didn't have... There was no revolutionary outbreaks any time in England in the 19th century. I mean, you might yell about Peterloo and so forth, but...
I'm not going to yell about Peterloo.
Bristol riots and so on, but they're really, really trivial. I mean, what used to interest me when we had a textbook in the Industrial Revolution, and there was one section on riots and disturbances, and I'd ask the
but
students
is this,
to
there
write
is
on
this famous statistic about there were more troops in the Midlands putting down Luddism in 1808 than there were in the Peninsula fighting the French.
Well, that's not just not true.
I don't know.
I don't think that's not just true. The Luddites were never any great threat.
Well, the state...
And again, see the... See, those protests, I mean, I was getting this point. I asked students to examine this section and comment on the lockout strikes and so forth. And they come back and say, isn't it shocking the way the workers were put down and so forth? And I said, how many strikes, lockouts were they? Well, it turns out they were about one every 3 years over the whole period of the first half of the 19th century. And they're trivial in numbers and so forth. How many people were killed as a result of industrial strife? Practically none. I mean, it was a bloodless revolution. The amount of unrest was really very small indeed. In any terms you'd like to measure it. And I mean, I think pints of blood is probably the best way of measuring
it. Yes, it is.
And there were very few pints of blood spilled.
Yes.
See, again, I mean, the greatest of all movements in this time, the Chartist movement, was completely bloodless. And it was one of the first mass movements which involved the so-called working class or working classes. But it's... there's no 1848, there's no 1830, there's no 1870. And people want to talk, say this is strange in Britain. I say, no, it's strange. What you've got to explain is the revolution over there, not the lack of revolution in Britain. We should explain both.
Yes.
But see, that view partly is engendered by Engels, because if you read Engels, I used to take great delight in reading out Engels to students who are on this subject. Engels, of course, is absolutely certain when he writes The Condition of the Working Classes that Britain was in a revolutionary situation. And the next cycle would bring a revolution more bloody than the French Revolution, he says. But of course it didn't, it never came. But still in the 1890s, you know, he's writing about the end of the century, saying it's coming then. And of course that bugs, I mean, if you look at, I mean, I once documented this, so you might have read the article on the revolution,
yes,
Monquet.
The Monquet.
You document it through, say, Hobbes, Woman, Thompson. They're always saying, if only this had happened. But of course it didn't happen.
No.
There was never any revolutionary threat in Britain at any time in the 19th century.
I think you and I can agree about that, but would you like to have been alive at the time? Was it a pleasant time to be alive?
Well, I think it all depends where you were, Paddy. I mean,
for most people, for the labouring poor, who the Hammonds and Asa Briggs used to write about, would you think it's a pleasant time to be
alive?
For
some it was okay, for some it wasn't. But see, again, you've got to compare it with what went before. I mean, the romanticising of rural life. Well, I'd like to put people in rural life. I mean, I grew up in rural life, and
you seem to have had a good time in rural life.
Milking cows,
established that.
Milking cows at 4 o'clock in the morning, cleaning out foul runs, and no, it's a great romanticising of rural life. Now, I think that most of the working classes, particularly in places like Lancashire, did quite well out of it. See, I think that a lot of the Industrial Revolution, particularly the social history, is worst-case history. As again I pointed out, that the main source for much of this are the parliamentary papers of inquiry. And there are massive volumes of it. I mean, year after year after year. And how did they arise? They arose because someone identified a problem, aired it in the House of Commons, arranged for an inquiry, which may usually be parliamentary inquiry or could be a royal commission. Now the stuff about this is that, of course, it's all problem-oriented inquiry. It's like the Health of Towns report. The Health of Towns report in the 1840s is one of the most horrifying documents I've ever read. But to conclude from that Britain was like this, as people did and as Engels did, it'd be like going, say, to the worst slums today of London and Glasgow and then writing them up and saying this is what England's like. Well, it is what England's like there and there. Mm-hmm. And it was also true of the 1840s. But it was not true of the whole country.
Well, shall we then reach for the economist's way of looking at it? That is to say, the standard of living, looking at money, wages and prices.
Right.
A great deal more research has been done since your time, obviously, and that's no critique of you. That shows that this hardly changes for a very, very long time.
Well, when you say no research was done, I mean, I think that probably the most comprehensive collective statistics on the Industrial Revolution wages was done by Bowley a long time ago.
Yes, but it's now been calibrated together by Charles Feinstein.
Well, I read that of Charles Feinstein's very carefully, and I don't think he proves his case. But, of course, again, he prejudices by saying that the people who don't agree with him always talk about a large increase in the standard of living, which, of course, they never did. I mean, let's look at my bit here. what I write is, since between 1780 and 1850, average per capita real income increased. Since there was no trend in distribution of income against the workers. Since after 1815, prices fell while wages remained constant. Since per capita consumption of food and other commodities, consumer goods increased. And since government intervened increasingly in economic social life to protect and improve living and working conditions, then the real wages of the majority of English workers were rising throughout the Industrial Revolution. This is not to say that the standard of living was high, even in 1900, nor that it was rising fast at any time before 1850, nor that there was no dire poverty and no serious cyclical or technological unemployment. But to admit the existence of distress is not to deny the upward trend in living standards nor the opportunities created by the new industrialisation. Mm. Now, I would still cling to that. For example, one question I used to ask students is, what happened to the goods of the Industrial Revolution? Now, they'd say exported. No, that doesn't account for them at all. I mean, most of them weren't exported. You have this massive increase in production. What happened to it, Paddy? It was mainly consumer goods because it was not capital goods. There were capital goods as well, but not consumer goods. And now, one of the arguments of the people, Hobsbawm and so on, is that so much of the savings went into investment goods that it, you know, lowered the standard of living. But Stan Engman did a sum once which absolutely disproved that view. And it was... See, it was production of ordinary goods, you know, of pots and pans and textiles and clothes. And they were produced in massive quantities. And again, see, it was a quick return because a factory was built quickly. It was in production less than 2 years, usually. And the third year was churning out goods. Mm-hmm. Now, certainly external trade was important, but it wasn't that important. It was domestic consumption which was the main... They were the main users of the Industrial Revolution goods. And I don't think that's ever... that huge study by Gaia Schwartz and Rostow, which is the only one that takes all the consumption goods. And see, the attempts, I think, to do it on wage series is, you know, no matter how many wage series you get, it's very difficult to generalise from, I think. I mean, I want the combination of wage series, investment decisions, consumption goods and so forth. And I think if you take the total picture, it's much more convincing. But again, I always emphasise, I always say that, and again, if I'm in my writing, that standard of living went up barely during the Napoleonic Wars. It started to increase thereafter, but it accelerated only in the 40s and 50s.
How do you explain the continued vitality and almost acrimony of the controversy about the standard of living in this particular period?
Well, I think it's...
I mean, it has been one of the most enduring and exciting controversies in history.
Oh, yes.
It rumbles on, and yeah. We're still at it, aren't
it's
we?
It's a non-stop train.
It's a non-stop controversy. Yes. How do you explain that?
Well, I think ideology is very important in it. That, see, as you know, the old theory was, and it still crops up in some of the historians we've mentioned, Hobsbawm, for example, there was a theory that there was a revolutionary situation in England in the first half of the 19th century.
Yes.
The proof of this, Marx said so, and enough evidence of distress and so forth to give some verisimilitude to the argument. Then unfortunate historical, and then the prediction, very confident prediction of Engels that the revolution will come, must come, it'll be more bloody than the French Revolution. Unfortunate historical fact is there was no revolution. And so then, of course, you get the invention of a counter-revolution to explain the non-revolution. The counter-revolution is couched in various ways. I mean, Engels used the word embourgeoisement, it's becoming that he said this is becoming the most bourgeois country in the world because the working class are even becoming bourgeois. Well, I don't think there was a crisis. I think there was a gradual improvement in living standards. I don't think there was ever a revolutionary threat, not even the slightest one, and that only heroic imagination would claim otherwise. Now, the other thing about this, of course, I've worked a lot on Yorkshire, so I can't be authoritative in all other areas, was the harmonious relationships between workers and employers. The yearly picnics, attention to the community in which they lived, and, of course, you had model towns make like Saltaire and so forth. And when you look at more closely, say, at factory conditions, you do not find that they were areas of class war. On the contrary, it was on the whole, they were institutions where both the employer or the owner and the workers realised it was in their common interest and accepted as such.
Trevor Roper once said, there is no history without controversy, and I think he's exactly right.
Oh, yes.
I'm glad to see there are some unregenerate old Whigs around to take on the young Turks who are reconfiguring the Britishness and the luck and everything else about the Industrial Revolution. I think we've now probably said enough about that, and at least enough to show that a lot of your philosophical positions and epistemological positions that you took as a member and latterly as president of the Mont Pelerin Society came out of your deep engagement with this particular period in British history. So I think we could now actually move on to talk about the Mont Pelerin Society and the very eminent economist that you met there, this liberal academy as it's called, which had such an influence on policy throughout the world in the 70s and the 80s. How do you account for its particular influence on policy generally of this rather odd academy?
Well, odd if you like. I mean, the thing is that, as you know, the 1930s was a period in which it was thought that capitalism was discredited. Then came the war, and of course wars are won by controls. I mean, there's no doubt about that the British economy was highly controlled during the war and was successfully controlled. And if you like, on the other hand, the German economy, on the other hand, was uncontrolled for a long time and, of course, lost the war. But that is, I think that's one reason, the so-called discrediting of capitalism. But, of course, the other thing was the hegemony of Keynes on economics. See, Keynes wrote, here's the general theory, which I studied the first year I was at university in the 30s, was written. It was really, as people say about Adam Smith, Adam Smith was a political tract of the times. The general theory was a political tract of the times.
Yes.
And his thesis was that you got into trouble through inefficient demand, and the way you got out of it was by government expenditure. Now, but as far as the Mont Pelerin Society goes, see, the post-war plans of the economies, all of them had plans after the war, which were largely interventionist. That you could, as Keynes said, regulate the economy by the manipulation of certain key variables, investment, etc., etc. And that gradually became discredited on the grounds that it didn't work. I mean, that was as simple as that. What was in its place? Well, I think there's a certain amount of confusion in the academies for some time about what is in this place. It's not certain exactly what's in this place even today. But in that time, I mean, no one or very few people believed in a state which wasn't highly interventionist. The finest hour of the Mont Pelerin Society was from the 40s through to the 70s, when it really argued and talked about liberal problems at a time when they were discredited and there was not much serious talk about them. After that, of course, the formation of other liberal academies, which there are in large numbers, the IEA, for example, and so Institute of Economic Affairs in England, things changed. But it was very important in bringing together an international gathering of highly able economists, George Stigler and Milton Friedman, for example.
Yes, at least
six or seven Nobel Prize winners. In my own case, of course, I had been thinking for years about my beliefs. I think one of the most interesting questions a person can ask himself is, why do I have these political, socio-political beliefs? It's a very interesting question.
It is.
And,
yes, it is.
I came, in my case, partly because of my background in Australia, but particularly in studying history. And there's no doubt in my mind that probably after the beginning, the most important thing, and more important than the philosophy which I read out, that was the study of history. That convinced me, people like Ashton, that it was the what I believed in. Now, I don't know how you define liberalism exactly, but I'll give you the definition which I made once, which seemed to me to be a reasonable one. The fundamental tenet of classical liberalism was the sufficiency of individual self-determination in belief and conduct as the proper basis for economic and political policy. The main principles of liberalism were, first, in the socio-political field, individual freedom and, where it was mutually beneficial, collaboration on a voluntary basis. Second, in the juridical field, individual property rights, freedom of contract and the rule of law. Third, in the economic field, freedom of enterprise in the form of the self-regulating market unrestrained by political intervention. In sum, minimum government and laissez-faire. Well, I think that's about as good a definition as I could give, and I think it would probably be acceptable to most people. But when I started to think about this seriously, I was particularly influenced by Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill.
Yes, I noticed when you were a member of the Society, you wrote a number of good essays, excellent essays on canonical figures, not merely Smith, but also Ricardo.
Ricardo, yes. Well, I edited the Pelican edition of Ricardo's Principles.
Yes.
But again, see, I mean, if you look in Book 5 of The Wealth of Nations and Book 5 of The Principles of Political Economy, both Book 5, you get the role of the state. We'll see. And the first two with Adam Smith are law and order and defence. But then he says, the third and last duty of the sovereign, or commonwealth, is that of erecting and maintaining those public institutions and those public works which, though they may be in the highest degree advantageous to a great society, are, however, of such a nature that the profit would never repay the expense of any individual or small number of individuals, and which it therefore cannot be expected that any individual or small number of individuals would erect or maintain. The performance of this duty requires, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, that seems to be as good a definition of public good as you'd get.
Yes.
And, of course, he mentioned education and, I think, bridges and so forth. And then John Stuart Mill, of course, was who extended what he saw. But, I mean, Mill argued that there is a circle around every individual human being which no government ought to be permitted to overstep. And that there are, quote, large departments of human life from which the government must be unreservedly and imperiously excluded. I think that's great stuff. I like that word, imperiously excluded.
Is that really an intellectual matter, or is it that the world has changed in ways that makes it necessary for the state to intervene?
No, I don't think it is. World has
changed. Because I just want to quote to you something you said here about intellectuals. Its members, you see, you're talking about the Montpellerin Society. Its members sought to countervail the view, quote, public provision of goods and services is necessary to combat the inefficiency and unfairness of the market system. A view that you characterise as trahison des clercs.
It is.
And you think the long history of state intervention in the 20th century is trahison des clercs?
I think that's taken. You don't have to read the rest of what I say. Yes, I do, Paddy. I think that the rationalisation of the intellectuals of practically every state intervention and the increasing invention of rights which demand state action is one of the most unfortunate developments of modern scholarship, if you like. The welfare state was devised to take care of the most unfortunate people in society. That's been developed to a stage where it's compulsory consumption. The government takes from me and it provides me with education, which is compulsory, it provides me with health, et cetera, et cetera. And, there are public goods elements in education, certainly, and in health. But does that mean that, you know, all education and all health should be provided by the state? I think that, what it does is, as John Stuart Mill argued very fiercely in the Principles of Political Economy, that by taking away people's ability to choose and to make decisions about themselves, it weakens their moral state, if you like.
You don't think this has something to do with the fact that we're all now crowded together in an urban civilization, which was quite different from the civilizations that even John Stuart Mill was arguing about? and that living side by side, cheek by jowl, that we all require more regulation, otherwise we're going to start killing each other or committing crimes against each other or stealing each other's property. Doesn't this require...
I'm all for law and order.
I mean, doesn't this require... But a lot of it is law and order now, isn't it?
Yes. No, I don't, Paddy.
And how isn't how we keep law and order to prevent people becoming disorderly by making sure they have minimal provision of this, that and the other?
No, but if you have a civil society, then a lot of that should or I would hope, disappear. Now, see, one of the arguments, again, for increasing government is the increasing complication of modern societies, economies and life.
But do you think markets provide a civil society automatically?
To a very important extent they do, yes, amongst a lot of other things. See, what do people want? I mean, it's all very easy for somebody to say, I know what you want. Well, he damn well doesn't know what I want. I know what I want. And I think most people are the same. I mean, I think people are the best judges of what they want and how they should be treated. Now, of course, there will always be criminals and thugs in society. I mean, after all, the free society, thievery is an occupational choice and sometimes pays very well. You do want to control, crimes and so forth, but that's done by having an effective police force.
Max, here's a quote which you characteristically and commendably have included in your history of the Mont Pelerin Society, and which no friend and former student can possibly resist throwing back at you. It's from Bertrand de Jouvenal, who, as you know, resigned from the Society in 1960. He explained he was leaving the Society because the Society believed that the state could do no good and private enterprise could do no wrong. Was that a fair comment? And could economic historians, who like you have investigated the role of states in economic growth, possibly subscribe to such a crude view? Is not another Nobel Prize winner, Arthur Lewis, correct to say, it is pointless to try and define a proper role for states? It all depends on time, place and circumstance.
Well, first of all, debate after debate in the Mont Pelerin Society was to try and answer the John Stuart Mill question, what are the proper limits and agencies of government? To what areas should they extend and how much should they do? And I think that is still the great question in politics. I don't know, there might have been other reasons for Bertrand de Jouvenal. I got that because it was a good letter and it was an outstanding quotation.
It was irresistible.
Irresistible, yes, I know. Arthur Lewis says that in every case you should look at the role of the state. Well, I agree. You can make generalisations, I mean, on the whole. I would say that the state should only interfere if there are real public goods or real public bads involved. You define defence as a public good and law and order as a public good, and perhaps certain part of education or health, to mention ones which are most generally provided by the state. But the Mont Pelerin Society was far from being a society of anarchists. Far from it. I mean, for example, most of them passionately believed in the gold standard. That's a sort of a free enterprise sort of concept, but of course it demands certain actions. No, I don't think it's a fair account at all. It's certainly not my view. I will attack the state wholeheartedly, but not on everything.
Max, you're not going to like this, but I'm going to have the last word. So
don't be so certain.
No, I'm never certain with you that I'm going to have the last word, but it's been a great privilege. For purposes of this interview, as you know, I've had to delve into your early life, and I've had to reread many of your books and gone over in my own mind, in my own way, the old arguments that you and I had together. And one of the things that I dug up in the course of doing this was that letter sent to you by E.P. Thompson, which I want to quote right at the end of this interview. And E.P. wrote to you. E.P., of course, is one of the most famous socialist historians of the 60s, for those who have not remembered his great works. He wrote, "How can I reconcile the Hartwell I know and love with the ideological monster you obviously are. Well, this is not a... they wouldn't have put it that way, but this is not a question that has not occurred to your students. And I think unanimously, to a man and a woman, they would say, it's because you're such a lovable, irritating, annoying scholar, mentor and gentleman. God bless you, and may you go on arguing with us for a very long time to come. Thank you.
Thank you.